I was housed at Dover, and another and a longer letter containing all particulars fully related, when my aunt took me formally under her protection. On my being settled at Dr. Strong's, I wrote to her again, detailing my happy condition and prospects. I never could have derived anything like the pleasure from spending the money Mr. Dick had given me that I felt in sending a gold half-guinea to Peggotty per post enclosed in this last letter to discharge the sum I had borrowed of her, in which epistle, not before, I mentioned about the young man with the donkey cart. To these communications Peggotty replied as promptly, if not as concisely, as a merchant's clerk. Her utmost powers of expression, which were certainly not great in ink, were exhausted in the attempt to write what she felt on the subject of my journey. Four sides of incoherent and interjectional beginnings of sentences that had no end except blots were inadequate to afford her any relief. But the blots were more expressive to me than the best composition, for they showed me that Peggotty had been crying all over the paper, and what could I have desired more? I made out without much difficulty that she couldn't take quite kindly to my aunt yet. The notice was too short after so long a prepossession the other way. "We never knew a person," she wrote, "but to think that Miss Betsy should seem to be so different from what she'd been thought to be was a moral." That was her word. She was evidently still afraid of Miss Betsy, for she sent her grateful duty to her but timidly, and she was evidently afraid of me too, and entertained the probability of my running away again soon, if I might judge from the repeated hints she threw out that the coach fare to Yarmouth was always to be had of her for the asking. She gave me one piece of intelligence which affected me very much, namely, that there had been a sale of the furniture at our old home, and that Mr. and Miss Murdstone were gone away and the house was shut up to be let or sold. God knows I'd had no part in it while they remained there, but it pained me to think of the dear old place as altogether abandoned, of the weeds growing tall in the garden, and the fallen leaves lying thick and wet upon the paths. I imagined how the winds of winter would howl round it, how the cold rain would beat upon the window glass, how the moon would make ghosts on the walls of the empty rooms, watching their solitude all night. I thought afresh of the grave in the churchyard underneath the tree, and it seemed as if the house were dead too now, and all connected with my father and mother were faded away. There was no other news in Peggotty's letters. Mr. Barkis was an excellent husband, she said, though still a little near. But we all had our faults, and she had plenty, though I'm sure I don't know what they were. And he sent his duty, and my little bedroom was always ready for me. Mr. Peggotty was well, and Ham was well, and Mrs. Gummidge was but poorly, and little Emily wouldn't send her love, but said that Peggotty might send it if she liked. All this intelligence I dutifully imparted to my aunt, only reserving to myself the mention of little Emily, to whom I instinctively felt that she wouldn't very tenderly incline. While I was yet new at Dr. Strong's, she made several excursions over to Canterbury to see me, and always at unseasonable hours, with the view, I suppose, of taking me by surprise. But finding me well employed and bearing a good character, and hearing on all hands that I rose fast in the school, she soon discontinued these visits. I saw her on a Saturday, every third or fourth week, when I went over to Dover for a treat, and I saw Mr. Dick every alternate Wednesday when he arrived by stagecoach at noon to stay until next morning. On these occasions Mr. Dick never travelled without a leathern writing-desk containing a supply of stationery and the memorial, in relation to which document he had a notion that time was beginning to press now, and that it really must be got out of hand. Mr. Dick was very partial to gingerbread. To render his visits the more agreeable, my aunt had instructed me to open a credit for him at a cake shop, which was hampered with the stipulation that he should not be served with more than 1 shilling's worth in the course of any one day. This, and the reference of all his little bills at the county inn where he slept to my aunt before they were paid, induced me to suspect that he was only allowed to rattle his money and not to spend it. I found on further investigation that this was so, or at least there was an agreement between him and my aunt that he should account to her for all his disbursements. As he had no idea of deceiving her and always desired to please her, he was thus made chary of launching into expense. On this point, as well as on all other possible points, Mr. Dick was convinced that my aunt was the wisest and most wonderful of women, as he repeatedly told me with infinite secrecy and always in a whisper. "Trotwood," said Mr. Dick, with an air of mystery after imparting this confidence to me one Wednesday. "Who's the man that hides near our house and frightens her?" "Frightens my aunt, sir?" Mr. Dick nodded. "I thought nothing would have frightened her," he said, "for she's..." Here he whispered softly, "Don't mention it. The wisest and most wonderful of women." Having said which, he drew back to observe the effect which this description of her made upon me. "The first time he came," said Mr. Dick, "was, let me see, 1649 was the date of King Charles's execution. I think you said 1649? "Yes, sir." "I don't know how it can be," said Mr. Dick, sorely puzzled and shaking his head. "I don't think I'm as old as that." "Was it in that year that the man appeared, sir?" I asked. "Why, really," said Mr. Dick, "I don't see how it can have been in that year, Trotwood. Did you get that date out of history?" "Yes, sir." "I suppose history never lies, does it?" said Mr. Dick with a gleam of hope. "Oh, dear, no, sir," I replied most decisively. I was ingenuous and young, and I thought so. "I can't make it out," said Mr. Dick, shaking his head. "There's something wrong somewhere. However, it was very soon after the mistake was made of putting some of the trouble out of King Charles's head into my head that the man first came. I was walking out with Miss Trotwood after tea just at dusk, and there he was, close to our house." "Walking about?" I inquired. "Walking about?" repeated Mr. Dick. "Let me see. I must recollect a bit. No, no, he wasn't walking about." I asked, as the shortest way to get at it, what he was doing. "Well, he wasn't there at all," said Mr. Dick, "until he came up behind her and whispered. Then she turned round and fainted, and I stood still and looked at him, and he walked away. But that he should have been hiding ever since in the ground or somewhere is the most extraordinary thing." "Has he been hiding ever since?" I asked. "To be sure he has," retorted Mr. Dick, nodding his head gravely. "Never came out till last night. We were walking last night, and he came up behind her again, and I knew him again." "And did he frighten my aunt again?" "All of a shiver," said Mr. Dick, counterfeiting that affection and making his teeth chatter. "Held by the palings. Cried. But, Trotwood, come here." Getting me close to him that he might whisper very softly, "Why did she give him money, boy, in the moonlight?" "He was a beggar, perhaps?" Mr. Dick shook his head, as utterly renouncing the suggestion, and having replied a great many times, and with great confidence, "No beggar, no beggar, no beggar, sir," went on to say that from his window he had afterwards, and late at night, seen my aunt give this person money outside the garden rails in the moonlight, who then slunk away into the ground again, as he thought probable, and was seen no more, while my aunt came hurriedly and secretly back into the house and had, even that morning, been quite different from her usual self, which preyed on Mr. Dick's mind. I had not the least belief in the outset of this story that the unknown was anything but a delusion of Mr. Dick's, and one of the line of that ill-fated prince who occasioned him so much difficulty. But after some reflection, I began to entertain the question whether an attempt, or threat of an attempt, might have been twice made to take poor Mr. Dick himself from under my aunt's protection, and whether my aunt, the strength of whose kind feeling towards him I knew from herself, might have been induced to pay a price for his peace and quiet. As I was already much attached to Mr. Dick and very solicitous for his welfare, my fears favoured this supposition. And for a long time his Wednesday hardly ever came round without my entertaining a misgiving that he wouldn't be on the coach box as usual. There he always appeared, however, grey-headed, laughing and happy, and he never had anything more to tell of the man who could frighten my aunt. These Wednesdays were the happiest days of Mr. Dick's life. They were far from being the least happy of mine. He soon became known to every boy in the school, and though he never took an active part in any game but kite-flying, was as deeply interested in all our sports as anyone among us. How often have I seen him, intent upon a match at marbles or peg-top, looking on with a face of unutterable interest and hardly breathing at the critical times. How often at Hare and Hounds have I seen him mounted on a little knoll, cheering the whole field unto action, and waving his hat above his grey head, oblivious of King Charles the Martyr's head and all belonging to it. How many summer hours have I known to be but blissful minutes to him in the cricket field? How many winter days have I seen him standing blue-nosed in the snow and east wind, looking at the boys going down the long slide and clapping his worsted gloves in rapture? He was an universal favourite, and his ingenuity in little things was transcendent. He could cut oranges into such devices as none of us had an idea of. He could make a boat out of anything from a skewer upwards. He could turn cramp bones into chessmen, fashion Roman chariots from old court cards, make spoke wheels out of cotton reels and bird cages of old wire. But he was greatest of all, perhaps, in the articles of string and straw, with which we were all persuaded he could do anything that could be done by hands. Mr. Dick's renown was not long confined to us. After a few Wednesdays, Dr. Strong himself made some inquiries of me about him, and I told him all my aunt had told me, which interested the doctor so much that he requested on the occasion of his next visit to be presented to him. This ceremony I performed, and the doctor begging Mr. Dick, whensoever he shouldn't find me at the coach office, to come on there and rest himself until our morning's work was over, it soon passed into a custom for Mr. Dick to come on as a matter of course, and if we were a little late, as often happened on a Wednesday, to walk about the courtyard waiting for me. Here he made the acquaintance of the doctor's beautiful young wife, paler than formerly all this time, more rarely seen by me or anyone, I think, and not so gay, but not less beautiful, and so became more and more familiar by degrees, until at last he would come into the school and wait. He always sat in a particular corner on a particular stool, which was called Dick after him. Here he would sit, with his grey head bent forward, attentively listening to whatever might be going on, with a profound veneration for the learning he had never been able to acquire. This veneration Mr. Dick extended to the doctor, whom he thought the most subtle and accomplished philosopher of any age. It was long before Mr. Dick ever spoke to him otherwise than bare-headed, and even when he and the doctor had struck up quite a friendship and would walk together by the hour on that side of the courtyard which was known among us as the Doctor's Walk, Mr. Dick would pull off his hat at intervals to show his respect for wisdom and knowledge. How it ever came about that the doctor began to read out scraps of the famous dictionary in these walks, I never knew. Perhaps he felt it all the same at first as reading to himself. However, it passed into a custom too, and Mr. Dick, listening with a face shining with pride and pleasure, in his heart of hearts believed the dictionary to be the most delightful book in the world. As I think of them going up and down before those schoolroom windows, the doctor reading with his complacent smile, an occasional flourish of the manuscript or grave motion of his head, and Mr. Dick listening, enchained by interest, with his poor wits calmly wandering God knows where upon the wings of hard words, I think of it as one of the pleasantest things in a quiet way that I have ever seen. I feel as if they might go walking to and fro forever, and the world might somehow be the better for it. As if a thousand things it makes a noise about were not one half so good for it. Or me. Agnes was one of Mr. Dick's friends very soon, and in often coming to the house he made acquaintance with Uriah. The friendship between himself and me increased continually, and it was maintained on this odd footing, that while Mr. Dick came professedly to look after me as my guardian, he always consulted me in any little matter of doubt that arose, and invariably guided himself by my advice. Not only having a high respect for my native sagacity, but considering that I inherited a good deal from my aunt. One Thursday morning, when I was about to walk with Mr. Dick from the hotel to the coach office before going back to school, for we had an hour's school before breakfast, I met Uriah in the street, who reminded me of the promise I'd made to take tea with himself and his mother, adding with a writhe, "But I didn't expect you to keep it, Master Copperfield, we're so very humble." I really hadn't yet been able to make up my mind whether I liked Uriah or detested him, and I was very doubtful about it still as I stood looking him in the face in the street, but I felt it quite an affront to be supposed proud, and said I only wanted to be asked. "Oh, if that's all, Master Copperfield," said Uriah, "and it really isn't our humbleness that prevents you, will you come this evening? But if it is our humbleness, I hope you won't mind owning to it, Master Copperfield, for we are well aware of our condition." I said I would mention it to Mr. Wickfield, and if he approved, as I had no doubt he would, I would come with pleasure. So, at 6 o'clock that evening, which was one of the early office evenings, I announced myself as ready to Uriah. "Mother will be proud indeed," he said as we walked away. "Or she would be proud if it wasn't sinful, Master Copperfield." "Yet you didn't mind supposing I was proud this morning," I returned. "Oh, dear, no, Master Copperfield," returned Uriah. "Oh, believe me, no, such a thought never came into my head. I shouldn't have deemed it at all proud if you had thought us too humble for you, because we are so very humble." "Have you been studying much law lately?" I asked, to change the subject. "Oh, Master Copperfield," he said, with an air of self-denial, "my reading is hardly to be called study. I have passed an hour or two in the evening sometimes with Mr. Tidd." "Rather hard, I suppose," said I. "He is hard to me sometimes," returned Uriah, "but I don't know what he might be to a gifted person." After beating a little tune on his chin as we walked on with the two forefingers of his skeleton right hand, he added, "There are expressions, you see, Master Copperfield, Latin words and terms in Mr. Tidd that are trying to a reader of my humble attainments." "Would you like to be taught Latin?" I said briskly. "I'll teach it you with pleasure as I learn it." "Oh, thank you, Master Copperfield," he answered, shaking his head. "I'm sure it's very kind of you to make the offer, but I am much too humble to accept it." "What nonsense, Uriah!" "Oh, indeed, you must excuse me, Master Copperfield. I am greatly obliged, and I should like it of all things, I assure you, but I am far too humble. There are people enough to tread upon me in my lowly state without my doing outrage to their feelings by possessing learning. Learning ain't for me. A person like myself had better not aspire. If he is to get on in life, he must get on humbly, Master Copperfield." I never saw his mouth so wide, or the creases in his cheeks so deep as when he delivered himself of these sentiments, shaking his head all the time and writhing modestly. "I think you're wrong, Uriah," I said. "I dare say there are several things that I could teach you if you'd like to learn them." "Oh, I don't doubt that, Master Copperfield," he answered, "not in the least. But not being humble yourself, you don't judge well, perhaps, for them that are. I won't provoke my betters with knowledge, thank you. I'm much too humble. Here's my humble dwelling, Master Copperfield." We entered a low, old-fashioned room, walked straight into from the street, and found there Mrs. Heap, who was the dead image of Uriah, only short. She received me with the utmost humility, and apologised to me for giving her son a kiss, observing that, lowly as they were, they had their natural affections which they hoped would give no offence to anyone. It was a perfectly decent room, half parlour and half kitchen, but not at all a snug room. The tea-things were set upon the table, and the kettle was boiling on the hob. There was a chest of drawers with an escritoire top for Uriah to read or write out of an evening. There was Uriah's blue bag lying down and vomiting papers. There was a company of Uriah's books, commanded by Mr. Tidd. There was a corner cupboard, and there were the usual articles of furniture. I don't remember that any individual object had a bare, pinched, spare look, but I do remember that the whole place had. It was perhaps a part of Mrs. Heep's humility that she still wore weeds. Notwithstanding the lapse of time that had occurred since Mr. Heep's decease, she still wore weeds. I think there was some compromise in the cap, but otherwise she was as weedy as in the early days of her mourning.
"This is a day to be remembered, my Uriah, I'm sure," said Mrs. Heep, making the tea, "when Master Copperfield pays us a visit."
"I said you'd think so, Mother," said Uriah.
"If I could have wished Father to remain among us for any reason,"
said Mrs. Heep,
"it would have been that he might have known his company this afternoon."
I felt embarrassed by these compliments, but I was sensible, too, of being entertained as an honoured guest, and I thought Mrs. Heep an agreeable woman.
"My Uriah," said Mrs. Heep to me, "has looked forward to this for a long while. He had his fears that our humbleness stood in the way, and I joined in them myself. Humble we are, humble we have been, humble we shall ever be,"
said Mrs. Heep.
"I'm sure you have no occasion to be so, ma'am," I said, "unless you like."
"Thank you, sir,"
retorted Mrs. Heep.
"We know our station and are thankful in it."
I found that Mrs. Heep gradually got nearer to me, and that Uriah gradually got opposite me, and that they respectfully plied me with the choicest of the eatables on the table. There was nothing particularly choice there, to be sure, but I took the will for the deed and felt that they were very attentive. Presently they began to talk about aunts, and then I told them about mine, and about fathers and mothers, and then I told them about mine. And then Mrs. Heap began to talk about fathers-in-law, and then I began to tell her about mine, but stopped, because my aunt had advised me to observe a silence on that subject. A tender young cork, however, would have had no more chance against a pair of corkscrews, or a tender young tooth against a pair of dentists, or a little shuttlecock against two battledores than I had against Uriah and Mrs. Heap. They did just what they liked with me, and wormed things out of me that I had no desire to tell, with a certainty I blush to think of, the more especially as, in my juvenile frankness, I took some credit to myself for being so confidential, and felt that I was quite the patron of my two respectful entertainers. They were very fond of one another, that was certain. I take it that had its effect upon me as a touch of nature, but the skill with which the one followed up whatever the other said was a touch of art which I was still less proof against. Well, there was nothing more to be got out of me about myself, for on the Murdstone and Grinby life, and on my journey, I was dumb. They began about Mr. Wickfield and Agnes. Uriah threw the ball to Mrs. Heep. Mrs. Heep caught it and threw it back to Uriah. Uriah kept it up a little while, then sent it back to Mrs. Heep. And so they went on tossing it about until I had no idea who'd got it and was quite bewildered. The ball itself was always changing, too. Now it was Mr. Wickfield, now Agnes, now the excellence of Mr. Wickfield, now my admiration of Agnes, now the extent of Mr. Wickfield's business and resources, now our domestic life after dinner, now the wine that Mr. Wickfield took, the reason why he took it, and the pity that it was he took so much, now one thing, now another, then everything at once. And all the time, without appearing to speak very often, or to do anything but sometimes encourage them a little, for fear they should be overcome by their humility and the honour of my company, I found myself perpetually letting out something or other that I had no business to let out, and seeing the effect of it in the twinkling of Uriah's dinted nostrils. I had begun to be a little uncomfortable and to wish myself well out of the visit, when a figure coming down the street passed the door. It stood open to air the room, which was warm, the weather being close for the time of year. Came back again, looked in, and walked in, exclaiming loudly, "Copperfield! Is it possible?" It was Mr. Micawber. It was Mr. Micawber, with his eyeglass and his walking stick and his shirt collar and his genteel air and the condescending roll in his voice all complete. "My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, putting out his hand, "this is indeed a meeting which is calculated to impress the mind with a sense of the instability and uncertainty of all human... In short, it's a most extraordinary meeting. Walking along the street, reflecting upon the probability of something turning up, of which I am at present rather sanguine, I find a young but valued friend turn up who is connected with the most eventful period of my life, I may say with the turning point of my existence. Copperfield, my dear fellow, how do you do?" I really cannot say that I was glad to see Mr. Micawber there. But I was glad to see him, too, and shook hands with him heartily, inquiring how Mrs. Micawber was. "Thank you," said Mr. Micawber, waving his hand as of old and settling his chin in his shirt collar. "She is tolerably convalescent. The twins no longer derive their sustenance from nature's founts. In short," said Mr. Micawber in one of his bursts of confidence, "they are weaned. And Mrs. Micawber is at present my travelling companion. She will be rejoiced, Copperfield, to renew her acquaintance with one who has proved himself in all respects a worthy minister at the sacred altar of friendship." I said I should be delighted to see her. "You're very good," said Mr. Micawber. Mr. Micawber then smiled, settled his chin again, and looked about him. "I have discovered my friend Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber genteelly and without addressing himself particularly to anyone, "not in solitude, but partaking of a social meal in company with a widow lady and one who is apparently her offspring. In short," said Mr. Micawber in another of his bursts of confidence, "her son. I shall esteem it an honour to be presented." I could do no less, under these circumstances, than make Mr. Micawber known to Uriah Heep and his mother, which I accordingly did. As they abased themselves before him, Mr. Micawber took a seat and waved his hand in his most courtly manner. "Any friend of my friend Copperfield's," said Mr. Micawber, "has a personal claim upon myself."
"We are too humble, sir," said Mrs. Heap, "my son and me, to be the friends of Master Copperfield. He's been so good as to take his tea with us, and we're thankful to him for his company. Also to you, sir, for your notice."
"Ma'am," returned Mr. Micawber with a bow, "you are very obliging. And what are you doing, Copperfield, still in the wine trade?" I was excessively anxious to get Mr. Micawber away, and replied, with my hat in my hand and a very red face, I have no doubt, that I was a pupil at Dr. Strong's. "A pupil?" said Mr. Micawber, raising his eyebrows. "I am extremely happy to hear it. Although a mind like my friend Copperfield's," to Uriah and Mrs. Heep, "does not require that cultivation which, without his knowledge of men and things, it would require, still it is a rich soil teeming with latent vegetation. In short," said Mr. Micawber, smiling in another burst of confidence, "it is an intellect capable of getting up the classics to any extent." Uriah, with his long hands slowly twining over one another, made a ghastly writhe from the waist upwards to express his concurrence in this estimation of me. "Shall we go and see Mrs. Micawber, sir?" I said, to get Mr. Micawber away.
"If you will do her that favour, Copperfield," replied Mr. Micawber, rising, "I have no scruple in saying, in the presence of our friends here, that I am a man who has, for some years, contended against the pressure of pecuniary difficulties." I knew he was certain to say something of this kind. He always would be so boastful about his difficulties. Sometimes I have risen superior to my difficulties. Sometimes my difficulties have, in short, have floored me. There have been times when I have administered a succession of faces to them. There have been times when they have been too many for me, and I have given in, and said to Mrs. Micawber in the words of Cato, "Plato, thou reasonest well. It's all up now. I can show fight no more." But at no time of my life, said Mr. Micawber, have I enjoyed a higher degree of satisfaction than in pouring my griefs, if I may describe difficulties chiefly arising out of warrants of attorney and promissory notes at 2 and 4 months by that word, into the bosom of my friend Copperfield. Mr. Micawber closed this handsome tribute by saying, "Mr. Heap, good evening. Mrs. Heap, your servant." And then walking out with me in his most fashionable manner, making a good deal of noise on the pavement with his shoes and humming a tune as we went. It was a little inn where Mr. Micawber put up, and he occupied a little room in it, partitioned off from the commercial room, and strongly flavoured with tobacco smoke. I think it was over the kitchen, because a warm, greasy smell appeared to come up through the chinks in the floor, and there was a flabby perspiration on the walls. I know it was near the bar, on account of the smell of spirits and jingling of glasses. Here, recumbent on a small sofa underneath a picture of a racehorse, with her head close to the fireplace and her feet pushing the mustard off the dumb waiter at the other end of the room, was Mrs. Micawber, to whom Mr. Micawber entered first, saying, "My dear, allow me to introduce to you a pupil of Dr. Strong's." I noticed, by the by, that although Mr. Micawber was just as much confused as ever about my age and standing, he always remembered as a genteel thing that I was a pupil of Dr. Strong's. Mrs. Micawber was amazed, but very glad to see me. I was very glad to see her, too, and after an affectionate greeting on both sides, sat down on the small sofa near her. "My dear," said Mr. Micawber, "if you will mention to Copperfield what our present position is, which I have no doubt he will like to know, I will go and look at the papers the while and see whether anything turns up among the advertisements." "I thought you were at Plymouth, ma'am," I said to Mrs. Micawber as he went out. "My dear Master Copperfield," she replied, "we went to Plymouth." "To be on the spot," I hinted. "Just so," said Mrs. Micawber, "to be on the spot. But the truth is, talent is not wanted in the custom house. The local influence of my family was quite unavailing to obtain any employment in that department for a man of Mr. Micawber's abilities. They would rather not have a man of Mr. Micawber's abilities. He would only show the deficiency of the others. Apart from which," said Mrs. Micawber, "I will not disguise from you, my dear Master Copperfield, that when that branch of my family, which is settled in Plymouth, became aware that Mr. Micawber was accompanied by myself, and by little Wilkins and his sister, and by the twins, they did not receive him with that ardour which he might have expected, being so newly released from captivity. In fact," said Mrs. Micawber, lowering her voice, "this is between ourselves, our reception was cool." "Dear me," I said. "Yes," said Mrs. Micawber. "It is truly painful to contemplate mankind in such an aspect, Master Copperfield, but our reception was decidedly cool. There is no doubt about it. In fact, that branch of my family which is settled in Plymouth became quite personal to Mr. Micawber before we'd been there a week. I said, and thought, that they ought to be ashamed of themselves. Still, so it was," continued Mrs. Micawber. "Under such circumstances, what could a man of Mr. Micawber's spirit do? But one obvious course was left, to borrow of that branch of my family the money to return to London, and to return at any sacrifice." "Then you all came back again, ma'am?" I said. "We all came back again," replied Mrs. Micawber. "Since then I have consulted other branches of my family.
on the course which it is most expedient for Mr. Micawber to take. For I maintain that he must take some course, Master Copperfield, said Mrs. Micawber argumentatively. It's clear that a family of six, not including a domestic, cannot live upon air. Certainly, ma'am, said I. The opinion of those other branches of my family, pursued Mrs. Micawber, is that Mr. Micawber should immediately turn his attention to coals.
To what, ma'am?
To coals, said Mrs. Micawber. To the coal trade. Mr. Micawber was induced to think on inquiry that there might be an opening for a man of his talent in the Medway coal trade. Then, as Mr. Micawber very properly said, the first step to be taken clearly was to come and see the Medway, which we came and saw. I say we, Master Copperfield, for I never will, said Mrs. Micawber with emotion, I never will desert Mr. Micawber. I murmured my admiration and approbation. We came, repeated Mrs. Micawber, and saw the Medway. My opinion of the coal trade on that river is that it may require talent, but that it certainly requires capital. Talent, Mr. Micawber has. Capital, Mr. Micawber has not. We saw, I think, the greater part of the Medway, and that is my individual conclusion. Being so near here, Mr. Micawber was of opinion that it would be rash not to come on and see the cathedral. Firstly, on account of its being so well worth seeing in our never having seen it, and secondly, on account of the great probability of something turning up in a cathedral town. We have been here, said Mrs. Micawber, 3 days. Nothing has, as yet, turned up. And it may not surprise you, my dear Master Copperfield, so much as it would a stranger, to know that we are at present waiting for a remittance from London to discharge our pecuniary obligations at this hotel. Until the arrival of that remittance, said Mrs. Micawber with much feeling, I am cut off from my home. I allude to lodgings in Pentonville, from my boy and girl, and from my twins. I felt the utmost sympathy for Mr. and Mrs. Micawber in this anxious extremity, and said as much to Mr. Micawber, who now returned, adding that I only wished I had money enough to lend them the amount they needed. Mr. Micawber's answer expressed the disturbance of his mind. He said, shaking hands with me, Copperfield, you are a true friend. But when the worst comes to the worst, no man is without a friend who is possessed of shaving materials. At this dreadful hint, Mrs. Micawber threw her arms round Mr. Micawber's neck and entreated him to be calm. He wept, but so far recovered almost immediately as to ring the bell for the waiter and bespeak a hot kidney pudding and a plate of shrimps for breakfast in the morning. When I took my leave of them, they both pressed me so much to come and dine before they went away that I couldn't refuse. But as I knew I couldn't come next day, when I should have a good deal to prepare in the evening, Mr. Micawber arranged that he would call at Dr. Strong's in the course of the morning, having a presentiment that the remittance would arrive by that post, and propose the day after, if it would suit me better. Accordingly, I was called out of school next forenoon, and found Mr. Micawber in the parlour, who had called to say that the dinner would take place as proposed. When I asked him if the remittance had come, he pressed my hand and departed. As I was looking out of window that same evening, it surprised me, and made me rather uneasy, to see Mr. Micawber and Uriah Heep walk past arm in arm. Uriah, humbly sensible of the honour that was done him, and Mr. Micawber taking a bland delight in extending his patronage to Uriah. But I was still more surprised when I went to the little hotel next day at the appointed dinner hour, which was 4 o'clock, to find, from what Mr. Micawber said, that he had gone home with Uriah and had drunk brandy and water at Mrs. Heep's. "And I'll tell you what, my dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, "your friend Heep is a young fellow who might be Attorney General. If I'd known that young man at the period when my difficulties came to a crisis, all I can say is that I believe my creditors would have been a great deal better managed than they were." I hardly understood how this could have been, seeing that Mr. Micawber had paid them nothing at all as it was, but I didn't like to ask. Neither did I like to say that I hoped he'd not been too communicative to Uriah, or to inquire if they'd talked much about me. I was afraid of hurting Mr. Micawber's feelings, or at all events Mrs. Micawber's, she being very sensitive. But I was uncomfortable about it, too, and often thought about it afterwards.
This ends side one of cassette 9. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
We had a beautiful little dinner. Quite an elegant dish of fish, the kidney end of a loin of veal roasted, fried sausage meat, a partridge and a pudding. There was wine and there was strong ale, and after dinner Mrs. Micawber made us a bowl of hot punch with her own hands. Mr. Micawber was uncommonly convivial. I never saw him such good company. He made his face shine with the punch so that it looked as if it had been varnished all over. He got cheerfully sentimental about the town and proposed success to it, observing that Mrs. Micawber and himself had been made extremely snug and comfortable there, and that he never should forget the agreeable hours they had passed in Canterbury. He proposed me afterwards, and he and Mrs. Micawber and I took a review of our past acquaintance, in the course of which we sold the property all over again. Then I proposed Mrs. Micawber, or at least said modestly, "If you'll allow me, Mrs. Micawber, I shall now have the pleasure of drinking your health, ma'am." On which Mr. Micawber delivered an eulogium on Mrs. Micawber's character, and said she had ever been his guide, philosopher, and friend, and that he would recommend me when I came to a marrying time of life to marry such another woman, if such another woman could be found. As the punch disappeared, Mr. Micawber became still more friendly and convivial. Mrs. Micawber's spirits becoming elevated too, we sang Auld Lang Syne, Mrs. Micawber leading, and Mr. Micawber and I singing chorus. When we came to "Here's a Hand, My Trusty Flare," we all joined hands round the table, and when we declared we would take a right good Willy Wacht and hadn't the least idea what it meant, we were really affected. In a word, I never saw anybody so thoroughly jovial as Mr. Micawber was, down to the very last moment of the evening, when I took a hearty farewell of himself and his amiable wife. Consequently, I was not prepared at 7 o'clock next morning to receive the following communication dated 9:30 in the evening, a quarter of an hour after I had left him. "My dear young friend, the die is cast, all is over. Hiding the ravages of care with a sickly mask of mirth, I have not informed you this evening that there is no hope of the remittance. Under these circumstances, alike humiliating to endure, humiliating to contemplate, and humiliating to relate, I have discharged the pecuniary liability contracted at this establishment by giving a note of hand, made payable 14 days after date at my residence, Pentonville, London. When it becomes due, it will not be taken up. The result is destruction, the bolt is impending, and the tree must fall. Let the wretched man who now addresses you, my dear Copperfield, be a beacon to you through life. He writes with that intention and in that hope. If he could think himself of so much use, one gleam of day might by possibility penetrate into the cheerless dungeon of his remaining existence, though his longevity is, at present, to say the least of it, extremely problematical. This is the last communication, my dear Copperfield, you will ever receive from the beggared outcast, Wilkins Micawber." I was so shocked by the contents of this heart-rending letter that I ran off directly towards the little hotel with the intention of taking it on my way to Dr. Strong's and trying to soothe Mr. Micawber with a word of comfort. But halfway there, I met the London coach, with Mr. and Mrs. Micawber up behind. Mr. Micawber, the very picture of tranquil enjoyment, smiling at Mrs. Micawber's conversation, eating walnuts out of a paper bag, with a bottle sticking out of his breast pocket. As they didn't see me, I thought it best, all things considered, not to see them. So, with a great weight taken off my mind, I turned into a by-street that was the nearest way to school,
and felt, upon the whole, relieved that they were gone, though I still liked them very much, nevertheless. Chapter 18, A Retrospect. My school days. The silent gliding on of my existence, the unseen, unfelt progress of my life from childhood up to youth. Let me think as I look back upon that flowing water, now a dry channel overgrown with leaves, whether there are any marks along its course by which I can remember how it ran. A moment, and I occupy my place in the cathedral, where we all went together every Sunday morning, assembling first at school for that purpose. The earthy smell, the sunless air, the sensation of the world being shut out, the resounding of the organ through the black-and-white arched galleries and aisles, are wings that take me back and hold me hovering above those days in a half-sleeping and half-waking dream. I'm not the last boy in the school. I've risen in a few months over several heads. But the first boy seems to me a mighty creature, dwelling afar off, whose giddy height is unattainable. Agnes says no, but I say yes, and tell her that she little thinks what stores of knowledge have been mastered by the wonderful being at whose place she thinks I, even I, weak aspirant, may arrive in time. He's not my private friend and public patron, as Steerforth was, but I hold him in a reverential respect. I chiefly wonder what he'll be when he leaves Dr. Strong's, and what mankind will do to maintain any place against him. But who is this that breaks upon me? This is Miss Shepherd, whom I love. Miss Shepherd is a boarder at the Mrs. Nettingall's establishment. I adore Miss Shepherd. She's a little girl in a spencer with a round face and curly flaxen hair. The Mrs. Nettingall's young ladies come to the cathedral too. I cannot look upon my book, for I must look upon Miss Shepherd. When the choristers chant, I hear Miss Shepherd. In the service, I mentally insert Miss Shepherd's name. I put her in amongst the royal family. At home, in my own room, I'm sometimes moved to cry out, "Oh, Miss Shepherd!" in a transport of love. For some time I am doubtful of Miss Shepherd's feelings, but at length, fate being propitious, we meet at the dancing school. I have Miss Shepherd for my partner. I touch Miss Shepherd's glove and feel a thrill go up the right arm of my jacket and come out at my hair. I say nothing tender to Miss Shepherd, but we understand each other. Miss Shepherd and myself live to be united. Why do I secretly give Miss Shepherd 12 Brazil nuts for a present, I wonder? They're not expressive of affection. They're difficult to pack into a parcel of any regular shape. They're hard to crack even in room doors, and they're oily when cracked. Yet I feel that they are appropriate to Miss Shepherd. Soft, seedy biscuits also I bestow upon Miss Shepherd, and oranges innumerable. Once I kiss Miss Shepherd in the cloakroom. Ecstasy! What are my agony and indignation next day when I hear a flying rumour that the Mrs. Nettingall have stood Miss Shepherd in the stocks for turning in her toes. Miss Shepherd, being the one pervading theme and vision of my life, how do I ever come to break with her? I can't conceive. And yet, a coolness grows between Miss Shepherd and myself. Whispers reach me of Miss Shepherd having said she wished I wouldn't stare so, and having avowed a preference for Master Jones. For Jones! A boy of no merit whatever. The gulf between me and Miss Shepherd widens. At last, one day, I meet the Mrs. Nettingall's establishment out walking. Miss Shepherd makes a face as she goes by and laughs to her companion. All is over. The devotion of a life
It seems a life, it's all the same, is at an end. Miss Shepherd comes out of the morning service, and the royal family know her no more. I'm higher in the school, and no one breaks my peace. I'm not at all polite now to the Mrs. Nettingall's young ladies, and shouldn't dote on any of them if there were twice as many and 20 times as beautiful. I think the dancing school a tiresome affair, and wonder why the girls can't dance by themselves and leave us alone. I'm growing great in Latin verses, and neglect the laces of my boots. Dr. Strong refers to me in public as a promising young scholar. Mr. Dick is wild with joy, and my aunt remits me a guinea by the next post. The shade of a young butcher rises, like the apparition of an armed head in Macbeth. Who is this young butcher? He's the terror of the youth of Canterbury. There's a vague belief abroad that the beef suet with which he anoints his hair gives him unnatural strength, and that he is a match for a man. He's a broad-faced, bull-necked young butcher with rough, red cheeks, an ill-conditioned mind, and an injurious tongue. His main use of this tongue is to disparage Dr. Strong's young gentleman. He says publicly that if they want anything, he'll give it them. He names individuals, among them myself included, whom he could undertake to settle with one hand and the other tied behind him. He waylays the smaller boys to punch their unprotected heads, and calls challenges after me in the open streets. For these sufficient reasons, I resolve to fight the butcher. It is a summer evening down in a green hollow at the corner of a wall. I meet the butcher by appointment. I am attended by a select body of our boys, the butcher, by two other butchers, a young publican, and a sweep. The preliminaries are adjusted, and the butcher and myself stand face to face. In a moment, the butcher lights 10,000 candles out of my left eyebrow. In another moment, I don't know where the wall is, or where I am, or where anybody is. I hardly know which is myself and which the butcher. We're always in such a tangle and tussle, knocking about upon the trodden grass. Sometimes I see the butcher, bloody but confident. Sometimes I see nothing and sit gasping on my second's knee. Sometimes I go in at the butcher madly and cut my knuckles open against his face, without appearing to discompose him at all. At last, I awake, very queer about the head, as from a giddy sleep, and see the butcher walking off, congratulated by the two other butchers and the sweep and publican, and putting on his coat as he goes, from which I augur justly that the victory is his. I'm taken home in a sad plight, and I have beefsteaks put to my eyes, and am rubbed with vinegar and brandy, and find a great white puffy place bursting out on my upper lip, which swells immoderately. For 3 or 4 days I remain at home, a very ill-looking subject, with a green shade over my eyes. And I should be very dull, but that Agnes is a sister to me, and condoles with me, and reads to me, and makes the time light and happy. Agnes has my confidence completely always. I tell her all about the butcher, and the wrongs he's heaped upon me, and she thinks I couldn't have done otherwise than fight the butcher, while she shrinks and trembles at my having fought him. Time has stolen on unobserved. For Adams is not the head boy in the days that are come now, nor has he been this many and many a day. Adams has left the school so long that when he comes back on a visit to Dr. Strong, there are not many there besides myself who know him. Adams is going to be called to the bar almost directly, and is to be an advocate and to wear a wig. I'm surprised to find him a meeker man than I'd thought, and less imposing in appearance. He's not staggered the world yet, either, for it goes on, as well as I can make out, pretty much the same as if he'd never joined it. A blank, through which the warriors of poetry and history march on in stately hosts that seem to have no end. And what comes next? I am the head boy now. And look down on the line of boys below me with a condescending interest in such of them as bring to my mind the boy I was myself when I first came there. That little fellow seems to be no part of me. I remember him as something left behind upon the road of life.
as something I've passed, rather than have actually been. I almost think of him as of someone else. And the little girl I saw on that first day at Mr. Wickfield's, where is she? Gone also. In her stead, the perfect likeness of the picture. A child likeness no more moves about the house. And Agnes, my sweet sister, as I call her in my thoughts, my counsellor and friend, the better angel of the lives of all who come within her calm, good, self-denying influence, is quite a woman. What other changes have come upon me besides the changes in my growth and looks and in the knowledge I've garnered all this while? I wear a gold watch and chain, a ring upon my little finger, and a long-tailed coat. And I use a great deal of bear's grease, which, taken in conjunction with the ring, looks bad. Am I in love again? I am. I worship the eldest Miss Larkins. The eldest Miss Larkins is not a little girl. She is a tall, dark, black-eyed, fine figure of a woman. The eldest Miss Larkins is not a chicken, for the youngest Miss Larkins is not that, and the eldest must be 3 or 4 years older. Perhaps the eldest Miss Larkins may be about 30. My passion for her is beyond all bounds. The eldest Miss Larkins knows officers. It is an awful thing to bear. I see them speaking to her in the street. I see them cross the way to meet her when her bonnet, she has a bright taste in bonnets, is seen coming down the pavement accompanied by her sister's bonnet. She laughs and talks and seems to like it. I spend a good deal of my own spare time in walking up and down to meet her. If I can bow to her once in the day, I know her to bow to, knowing Mr. Larkins, I am happier. I deserve a bow now and then. The raging agonies I suffer on the night of the race ball, where I know the eldest Miss Larkins will be dancing with the military, ought to have some compensation if there be even-handed justice in the world. My passion takes away my appetite and makes me wear my newest silk neckerchief continually. I have no relief but in putting on my best clothes and having my boots cleaned over and over again. I seem then to be worthier of the eldest Miss Larkins. Everything that belongs to her or is connected with her is precious to me. Mr. Larkins, a gruff old gentleman with a double chin and one of his eyes immovable in his head, is fraught with interest to me. When I can't meet his daughter, I go where I'm likely to meet him, to say, "How do you do, Mr. Larkins? Are the young ladies and all the family quite well?" Seem so pointed that I blush. I think continually about my age. Say, I am 17, and say that 17 is young for the eldest Miss Larkins. What of that? Besides, I shall be 21 in no time almost. I regularly take walks outside Mr. Larkins' house in the evening, though it cuts me to the heart to see the officers go in, or to hear them up in the drawing-room where the eldest Miss Larkins plays the harp. I even walk, on 2 or 3 occasions, in a sickly, spoony manner round and round the house after the family are gone to bed, wondering which is the eldest Miss Larkins' chamber, and pitching, I dare say now, on Mr. Larkins instead, wishing that a fire would burst out, that the assembled crowd would stand appalled, that I, dashing through them with a ladder, might rear it against her window, save her in my arms, go back for something she'd left behind, and perish in the flames. For I'm generally disinterested in my love, and think I could be content to make a figure before Miss Larkins and expire. Generally, but not always. Sometimes brighter visions rise before me. When I dress, the occupation of 2 hours, for a great ball given at the Larkins, the anticipation of 3 weeks, I indulge my fancy with pleasing images. I picture myself taking courage to make a declaration to Miss Larkins.
I picture Miss Larkins sinking her head upon my shoulder and saying, "Oh, Mr. Copperfield, can I believe my ears?" I picture Mr. Larkins waiting on me next morning and saying, "My dear Copperfield, my daughter has told me all. Youth is no objection. Here are £20,000. Be happy."